My name is Debo Powers, and today is October 15th, 2011. I'm interviewing for the first time Larry Wilson. This interview is taking place at 286 Kentla Ranch Road, north of Polebridge, Montana. This interview is sponsored by the North Fork Landowners Association and is part of the North Fork History Project. So, Larry, tell us a little bit about your early background, where and when you were born.
I was born in Kalispell in 1937. And except for a short period when I thought I wanted, after I graduated from college, I went to Arizona thinking I wanted to get out of Montana. 2 years convinced me I wanted to come home. So I came home and started teaching in Columbia Falls in 1960. In 1972, I quit teaching. 1974, I guess. 1974, I quit teaching and went into the logging business. Mm-hmm. And I retired from that in 2002. And here I am.
And here you are. So how did you get to the North Fork? How did you find out about it?
It's interesting. This project caused me to think about the first time I was here. Because I've always thought, when my dad bought Kentler Ranch, that was when we really came here. But the first time that I can remember when we came to the North Fork was during World War II. And I'm not sure the year, 42, I think, mm-hmm. maybe 43, but I was 4 or 5 years old. And my dad had just been promoted to lieutenant colonel and had to leave, and we came home and we camped at the mouth of Quail Creek. And I was pretty small, so my dad carried me when we went fishing across and forded Quail Creek, and he caught 2 15-pound bull trout that day that we kept alive for all the time that we were camping there, mm-hmm. and then took home and smoked. And at that time, the old homestead barn was sitting near the mouth of Whale Creek, and we found a dead coyote inside.
Oh.
Little kids aren't turned off by dead coyotes, so my dad helped me, and we saved the skull and bleached it, and I had it in my room till I graduated from college, I guess. So that was the first time on the North Fork. And then after the war, in 1947, my dad bought Kentler Ranch. And that really started where we lived here. Mm-hmm. When he sold it in 1953, the next summer, the new owners of Kentler Ranch didn't operate it as a dude ranch and hired me as a caretaker. And the money that I earned as a caretaker allowed me to buy this property from Tom Reynolds. So basically, been here since 1947.
Well, when your family owned Kentler Ranch, did you operate it as
a
dude ranch?
Yeah. My dad was a game warden at the time, so my mother really operated Kentler Ranch. We had a wrangler and a cook and 2 girls that did housekeeping and waiting tables. And sometimes a handyman.
And you had guest houses, so people came up and stayed?
At that time, Kentler Ranch had 6 housekeeping cabins where people could come and rent the cabins and cook and stay there on their own. And we had 8 cabins up around the lodge for guests who ate at the lodge. And mm-hmm. things were pretty expensive in those days, $10 a night, I think, they spent.
That's great. Did you... So what age were you when your family owned Kentler Ranch?
We bought it in 1947, so I was 10.
10. So as a young boy, you probably had a good time around the ranch.
Oh, yeah, it's a great place for kids.
Yeah, I bet.
Bart Monahan was still on his homestead, and we would go visit him and ride horses anywhere. Played kick the can on horseback. Matt Brill came and helped. Anytime we had pack trips, Matt and Maida came and helped. So I knew the Brills, Bart Monahan, Holcombs, and Wirtz's were all still here living on the North Fork at that time.
Mm-hmm. So when you had guests come up, did you take them, you took them on?
We take them on day rides. Mm-hmm. Mostly then the guests that we had were not like McFarland's. At McFarland's, they were Western cowboy type dude ranch. Based on horseback riding. Kentler Ranch was more a long standing clientele. People had been coming here for 20-some years, and they came to fish mostly. But we took day rides and occasional pack trips for people to fish at Kentla Lake and Upper Kentla Lake, and hike into Frozen Lake. There was no road then. And they fished a lot in Canada also. At that time, the border was open, manned only by a Canadian who acted for the U.S. and Canada. And he could sell Canadian fishing licenses. So we'd drive up there, guests would fish. Wasn't much floating the river in those days.
Yeah. That's kind of new, isn't it? Well, you were a young boy and you were living in Kentla Ranch. Did you go to school up here?
Or? No. We went in the winter, we went to Kalispell, and I went to school in Kalispell. Mm-hmm. That was kind of a change, because during the war, I went to 13 different elementary schools for 6 grades. And then when we came home to stay after the war, then I attended school in Kalispell.
Uh-huh. Okay. So how many months a year was your family up here?
Well, my mother would come as soon as the road was open. And then my little brother and I would come as soon as school was out. Mm-hmm. And my dad would just be here on weekends and during his vacation time from the state.
Because mm-hmm. he worked for the state.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. we stayed until school started. Although my mother stayed longer because we had the hunting concession in Canada at that time. Mm-hmm. So we ran a hunting camp till the end of October at least, and if the snow wasn't too deep, till the end of November.
You had the ideal way to grow up.
Yes.
You are a lucky man, Larry Wilson. Well, what was the North Fork like during that time when you were young?
Well, I get a kick out of people who say it's like it was now, and it isn't. At that time, the homesteaders were still here. They were just beginning to get old. And, of course, they sold to retire, mm-hmm. many of them. That was the only real asset they had, was their land. And so, slowly, summer people came on the scene. The very first, I think, in 1948, the second year we were here, maybe it was 49, the Foremans came, and they were the first of the real summer people that we knew on this side of the river. There were some summer people that you'll be interviewing, I think, that were park employees that we never thought about. It was not part of our social life, I guess. But the park employees were also summer residents, and many of them then later bought land like McNeil's and Moss's and Walters, and had cabins in on this side of the river.
Mm-hmm. Edwards and...
Edwards, yeah.
You were in Hart's, yeah, Hart.
Was Hart a summer employee at the park?
No, he wasn't a summer, but he was up here in the summer, yeah. Okay, well, you knew a lot of the homesteaders then.
Oh, yeah, they were neat.
Tell me about some of them.
Bart Monahan was a bachelor homesteader up here. He lived in a little cabin on property that Chrisman's own now, and in a very little cabin, about 8 by 12 feet inside. And the interior of his cabin was black from creosote, from the lodgepole pine that he burnt for firewood.
Oh, ooh.
And he was one of the neat guys that I really liked. He was always friendly and would sit and talk. He was, getting quite old at that time. But he took one bath a year, and that was on a sunny day in May. And he would pack his galvanized tub out in under the underhang of his porch, build a fire under it, heat water, take his bath, and put on brand new long johns in May, which he cut the buttons off and sewed up the front. And the only buttons remaining were the trap door, and he didn't take them off till the next May.
Wow.
So if you touched his bed, your hand would be black because everything was just coated solid black. And we never ate there. So I don't know how he ate, but he was one of the neat guys. And Charlie Wise was another. At the time we knew him, he was a bachelor. His wife had died of the flu epidemic in 1918 up here. He homesteaded what is now Square Peg Ranch. And his wife died, of the flu. His little daughter choked on a button, and he carried her in his arms from Pulbridge to town.
And to she Columbia died. Falls.
Yeah, clear to Columbia Falls. Well, yeah. I'm not sure. I'd have to look that up again. I can't remember. Since there was no road to Columbia Falls probably in 1918, so he probably went down the park, got to Belton, got on the train, went to Whitefish where there was a hospital. But whatever, his whole family died, and he was, by the time I knew him, quite elderly, and the caretaker of the oil well in Canada, just across the border. But he treated all of us kids like we were adults. He gave me my first shot of whiskey. And my mother was not happy about that, since I was only 11 years old, I think. We used to have dances every month. First Saturday of every month, which became NFIA meeting nights, we'd have a meeting followed by a dance, and the dance lasted until after midnight. And sometimes it started up again after midnight and went till daylight. Just depended on the band, because we always had live music then. And there was no drinking in the buildings. At that time, the dances were mostly at Quarter Circle MC in the park or Kentler Ranch, alternating months. And the men would drink outside. There was no drinking in the building. But I can, boy, Ruth Saunderson, when she'd catch Lloyd drinking, you know, she'd whop on him good and then go and make him go to the car and stay there. But the homestead, Frank and Ella Wirtz, you know, were just super people. I still have a pair of her moccasins that she made from moose hide. My dad always had them. That's what he wore, socks, then moccasins, then his packs in the winter, mm-hmm. so that when he got into the tent or in camp at night, he could take off his boots and wear his moccasins. Holcombs, you know, tremendous people. Nobody who ever met Lena could forget her smile, I'm sure. And when Pa Holcomb would come out, he'd always say, "Well, come and set a spell." And when you went into their kitchen, because that's where he always went to sit, then Ma Holcomb would always say, "Well, you got to have a bite to eat," and she'd bring out something. And they had a big, monstrous garden. They canned all their own vegetables. They canned their meat. Just amazing people, amazingly tough people, those homesteaders. They, you know, Frank Newton was a packer for the Forest Service. His wife was the daughter of another homesteader. So, yeah, they were just neat. Billy Adair was still there, but I never really knew him. The Pulbridge Merc, the first people I really knew were an old smiling Ben Rover, who never smiled, and his wife Annette, and they had the post office at Pulbridge. And she was infamous for reading everybody's postcards. And when people complained, she'd just say, "Well, if you want it private, you put it in an envelope and seal it. If you write it on a postcard, it's for anybody to read." And she did. She was always commenting on postcards that people received.
So was the post office at their cabin, the Ben River cabin, or was it?
No, that was long. That was not even there then. They lived in what is now the saloon.
Okay, and it was in that spot.
And the post office was in the store.
Okay.
There was also a post office at that time at Moose City. Mm-hmm. That Madge Cooper was Madge Terrian was the postmistress. And Madge was not a homesteader. The homestead at the border was, the homesteader was Frank Clute, and Madge retired from the railroad as a telegrapher, and she bought Frank Clute's place. And I don't know whether he moved, he died, or what, but Madge was there, and she always believed that oil would be found on the North Fork. And so she was the real classic case of land poor. She had several thousand acres scattered around the whole North Fork, property that's now, well, attached, well, let's see, who owns it today? I think Jim Gatiss bought some of it, mm-hmm. from Stoltz, that Madge owned, and Peter Gwynn owned some. Both of the homesteads at Hoyle Creek and the community hall belonged to Madge, and Madge and Ollie donated the land that the community hall sits on to the NFIA. and she had thousands of acres of oil leases in Canada. She, and that's where the name Moose City came from. She had it all laid out, that big hay meadow that it's now an airstrip, would be laid out as a town when the oil boom came. Mm-hmm. And so she had it all laid out and planned, but of course it never happened in her lifetime anyway. Mm-hmm. And she died, I don't know, I must have been 25 or 26 years old because I was teaching school in Columbia Falls when she died. And Ollie then stayed on the North Fork and worked for the Foremans for several years and lived at their lake cabin, which was Ed Peterson's homestead house, for two or three years. And then he moved to town and lived with me until he died. He didn't die at my house. He died of lung cancer in a VA hospital. But he was a World War II vet. And Ralph Thayer, of course, owned the property just south of me, and he was one of the last homesteaders to die, actually. And somebody asked me, geez, didn't he ever marry? I think he married five or six times. He had lots of wives. He just outlived them, is all. And when he was in the soldier's home and knew he wasn't coming, he went to World War I. He had just started building the cabin at Ford Ranger Station now when he left for World War I, and they didn't finish it till he came back, and then he finished it working for the Forest Service. He was probably one of the more famous early rangers up here. He ran like a deer and laid out most of the trails that are on the North Fork on the Forest Service side. And one time running through the woods, he jumped over his big down larch tree and lit right in the middle of a grizzly bear. And just kept running and got up the tree, but the grizzly got him by the leg. And didn't quite pull him out of the tree, but pulled his boot down, injured him pretty badly. But he managed to walk, I can't remember exactly now, 6 or 9 miles out to where somebody picked him up. And he didn't run as fast after that. Mm-hmm. And of course he didn't. He died relatively recently, only 20 years ago or something now. And his place, his homestead cabin, is owned by Nancy Hubble today. Mm-hmm. And his homestead is divided into many parts. Harrods are on there, Brooks, Green, Novak, Docals, Halsey's.
He had a big piece of land.
He had 160 acres, and it's most of them now. Well, Novak's and Ocal's, I know, each have 20 acres now. I don't know what Anne Marie's got. But, and Green has more than 10, but I don't think it's 20. I'm not sure, but yeah, it's broken up pretty badly. It was the last year he was alive. He sold his homestead house and 40 acres to Hubble's. Because, well, I don't know why or how, but they bought it, and then he had the 120 left, and he called me from the soldier's home one time and offered me the property for $1,000 an acre, which was a little bit low at that time, but not way low. And I said, geez, why'd you call me? And he said, well, I thought maybe you'd buy it and you wouldn't subdivide it. And I said, no, I don't have that kind of money, you know, $120,000. If I bought it, I'd have to subdivide it, so you don't want to sell it to me. So he sold it to Johnny Matheson that had purchased his original 40, and to Johnny and his partner at that time, Ed Ernst. They were horse loggers. And they, as soon as Ralph was dead, they subdivided into 10-acre parcels. Mm. So that's how it got all broken down. What other homesteader? Well, Tom Reynolds wasn't a homesteader, but he'd been here longer than anybody. He's the one I bought this property from. He purchased it during the Depression for $1 an acre. That was the back taxes owed. And he sold it to me for $10 an acre. And then he got to thinking, well, I think I was 14 or 15 when I bought it. And he was afraid the people up here would think he took advantage of me. So he threw in a Model T truck with a spare engine. And I sold the truck that fall for enough to pay for the land.
Really?
So the land was really free.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah. The interesting thing was it had a spare engine, and the truck, the Model T truck that it came out of, was sitting on the property. And it had been there for years and years and years. When we were kids, we'd walk from Kentler Ranch out to the main road to get the mail, and we'd play in that truck. And about 5 years after I bought this property, the truck disappeared. Mm. And later found out somebody'd seen Frank Evans loading it up. So I called Frank, and he said, "Well, Tom Reynolds gave it to me." I said, "Well, I don't think so, since it wasn't his anymore. It was mine and on my property." But it was kind of a landmark where it sat, but Frank took it. I think he fixed it up or used it as parts of several to put together one. And his son, I think, still owns it. So that was probably better than if it just sat there and rusted anyway. Tom and Marie Peterson were here when we came too. And they live where Mary O'Hare owns their house now. And they lived here year-round. He used to work out, but by the time I was here, she was a lot younger than Tom. And when he was ill, he had degenerative heart disease, and they'd take him out for most of the winter. But while they were living here, she would snowshoe from their homestead, which is about, 8 miles,
mm-hmm.
out to the main road and meet the mail, and then snowshoe 8 miles home. And they had, for all the people who lived on Trail Creek at that time, they had a little cabin, just 6x6 or something, sat right at the junction of Trail Creek and road and the main road, with a little sheet metal stove in it that they could sit and wait for the mail. Or once the mail came, then you could answer your mail sitting in that warm little cabin and put it in the mailbox, and the mailman on his way down would pick it up and then snowshoe home. But high school kids in the mid-50s just put a cable around that little cabin and pull it up the road, and it all fell apart.
Oh.
And it's never been replaced.
Oh.
Although Tom Marks, who owns that site now, has told us many times that we could rebuild Uncle Tom's cabin if we wanted to, but we never have.
Is that what it was called?
That's what it was called, Uncle Tom's cabin.
So did the mail come twice a week?
Twice a week, just like it does now? Just like it does now.
Uh-huh.
It was a little different. We had mail bags. And you put your outgoing mail in a bag that the mailman would take to town. And you picked up your mail in the other bag.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite a contest up here who had the best looking mail bags. And it was all sorted in town, and they'd put your mail in a bag, and you'd take that bag out, put your other bag with the outgoing mail in the box for the mailman to take to town. And if you didn't have any outgoing, you still sent the empty bag in. And I always wondered, I wonder what happened to all those mail bags.
So did people actually decorate them?
Or? Oh, sure. You had to.
So you got your own mail bag back
every time.
Your name was on it.
You had to provide your own, and ours said Kentler Ranch on it.
Uh-huh.
Most others had Reynolds or Peterson or whatever their names were. And they were made from a variety of things. At that time, everybody bought feed in 100-pound bags. And the feed bags were flowered patterns and stuff. And mm-hmm. people used those for mail bags and pillowcases. And women even made skirts out of flower bags, feed bags.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And diapers. They were, because there were no throwaway diapers in those days. What other homesteaders were here then? Ed Peterson was here, but nobody saw much of him. He was gone by about 1950 or 51. He had shot and killed Billy Cruz up here in 1932. And he was found innocent by reason of self-defense, but he was always real shy after that. And I met one of his great nephews or something this summer that was here. So hopefully we're going to get some pictures of Ed and his brother Emil, which is the property that Foreman's own now.
Mm-hmm. So you mentioned the Newtons, or Ethel Newton?
Well, Ethel was, I think, a Henson. Yeah, she was a Henson.
Right. That's right.
She was a granddaughter of Vance, who homesteaded down there on the flat where Iola Mason owns now. That was a Vance homestead. And the Hansons were the ones responsible for the name Pole Bridge. Billy Adair built the Mercantile, what is we call now the Pole Bridge Mercantile, in 1914 or so it opened. And it was called Adair. And if you look at the old maps, that's what's on it, Adair. But the Hensons felt that he was charging too much. And so they built another store that was located about halfway between the Merc and the bridge. And I've got some old pictures of it in the homestead house somewhere.
Which side of the road was it on?
It was on the left-hand side, right. You know where the loop road is?
Uh-huh.
Where the loop road comes around, it was just past that net opening. And, of course, the remnants all burned in 88 in the Red Bench Fire. They were, up until then, you could see the collapsed building still there. And that's how she got the postmistress job, which had previously been a Kentlet post office in the park. And they closed it and moved down to Pole Bridge. And Mrs. Henson is the one who named Pole Bridge. She named it after, of course, after the bridge.
Mm-hmm.
And they ran that store. It was never open when I was up here, so it closed sometime.
This is the same store that the Adairs had,
this is the store that the Hansons had. Other store, yeah. And
she called that one Pole Bridge.
Yeah, that was the original Pole Bridge.
Uh-huh.
And then when it closed and they moved, then Adair finally got the post office at the Mercantile.
Uh-huh.
And after Adair sold, then it became known as the Pole Bridge Mercantile.
Oh, and do you know what year that was?
About 1948. Mm-hmm. Rovers came, I think.
Uh-huh.
48 or 49. That's when Smiling Ben showed up.
He never smiled, huh?
He never smiled. I never saw him smile.
Did everybody call him Smiling Ben, or just you?
I don't know. Just me, for sure. I know I did. All of us kids did.
Uh-huh.
And he and Annette sold that place four or five times. Well, they didn't actually sell it. They leased it for a year, and then people were supposedly going to have an option to buy. But he made them buy the inventory, and he didn't move out until about first snow. And then the people were trapped there for the winter with no customers. There were precious few. There were still a few homesteaders around that bought a few things in the winter. The mail stopped there, you know, but they couldn't make a living at it. And then Ben and his wife would cancel the lease in the spring and come back for the summer themselves. I've got a newspaper article that was written by a lady in Yuma, Arizona, she and her husband, with their little kids, had spent a winter at Pole Bridge, one of the customers of the Rovers. See, Ladenburg was not a homesteader, but his, I think it would have been his great uncle, was one of the original employees of the Anaconda Company that came to file for coal rights and homesteads that they would then sell to the Anaconda Company. But since the coal didn't pan out, they ended up, some of them, keeping theirs, and Mickey Byrne was his name. He kept his and bought a bunch of others, and so ended up with that big place. Also, an original people up here was Pat Walsh's uncle. Yeah, uncle. Pat was the son of the sheriff for many years in Platted County, and his older brother was one of the first people who came up here with the oil people building, I don't know what kind of roads, to move in big steam engines to power the drilling plants. And if you go to Upper Kentlet Lake, or at the head of Lower Kentlet Lake, you'll find the old boiler is still laying there in the water. And it came up here pulled by horses. It's hard to imagine.
It is hard.
And across the border in Canada, only about 3 miles from the border, is another oil well that also has a big steam boiler. It's still sitting there, I'm sure. It's been 10 years since I've been across the border here, but at that time the oil derricks still stood too, in most of the buildings.
So if you hike up to Upper Kentler, or you said Lower Kentler?
Lower Kentler. It's at the head of Lower Kentler.
You can find it?
Oh yeah, it's sticking right out on the edge of the water.
Oh. That'd be good to take a picture of that.
Oh yeah, I'm sure there are pictures of it. I don't know if I have any anywhere or not, but probably. Mm-hmm. It's been quite a while since I've hiked Kentler. We used to horseback ride.
Mm-hmm.
up there a lot, to Upper Kentland, camp. But the park was easier to enter, too, then. You could camp anywhere you wanted, and you didn't have to have permission, mm-hmm. you know, and check in. If we decided we were going to go to Boulder Pass, we'd just saddle the horses mm-hmm. and go. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if that would fly today.
It wouldn't today.
No. No, you got to pay a fee to camp on our land.
Because there's so many people, I guess.
Yeah.
Well, the original homesteaders used the inside road to come up, right?
Until 1954, the inside road was a better road than the main road. Mm-hmm. In 1954, the spruce beetle epidemic hit the North Fork, and the spruce were all infested. And so the Forest Service improved the road from Columbia Falls to Whale Creek Road. And that's when they began building the side roads, Whale Creek Road. I don't know about Red Meadow, but they logged heavily up Red Meadow. All the drainages were logged, Trail Creek too. And the Forest Service then remained involved for many years while heavy logging went on up here. And that improved the road so that it was better than the inside road. If you travel the inside road today, it's about like it was.
It's about like it was back then.
Back then, right. Uh-huh. And my mother and Ruth Saunderson were the big speed demons on the road because Ruth was cooking for a logging crew, and my mother was cooking for the guest ranch, and so weekly they made trips to Belton to buy groceries. They didn't go to Columbia Falls very often because the road was better to Belton. Mm-hmm. And they would, of course, feed breakfast, get in the car and run like mad for Belton, get their groceries and get back in time to cook dinner. And it was when my mother once made the trip in 2.5 hours, that was considered a record. And if you've ever been up Anaconda Hill and all those narrow roads, you know, it's a narrow road.
Yeah.
But the road, the cars weren't as good, mm-hmm. but there weren't many of them on the road either. Mm-hmm. I've always been a counter, and when we came up the road, we'd count the cars we met. And 20 was a big, you knew it must be the 4th of July or something, to have 20 cars on the road. This summer, I still count cars. And this summer, I averaged 30 cars between Camas Bridge and Pole Bridge every day till after Labor Day. Mm-hmm. And 10 or 15 from Pole Bridge to here. Mm-hmm. And since I go through the park, I never counted the ones to Columbia Falls because that road is too rough now.
Mm-hmm. So what was the road like when you first came up here as a young boy?
It literally had grass growing in the middle of the road. And when you met somebody, you both had to get over. And when logging trucks came, you sometimes had to back up to find a place to get, because they couldn't back up. Mm-hmm. The first time after we bought Kentler Ranch and we came here, the thing I remember, it was after dark when we got here. And the road from the North Fork Road down to Kentler Ranch, which is 1.5 miles, you couldn't see the sky because the branches of the trees overlapped the whole road. And it was that way almost to the border. You know, grass in the middle. It was rough. The flats were common, of course, but the biggest thing I remember is people who would bang their oil pan, knock a hole in their oil pan and lose their oil. So there were all kinds of interesting remedies for how you fix that. You know, drop the oil, you drive a wooden peg in and then you wouldn't leak enough oil, you could make it to town, or take it off like Matt Brill would always do. He'd patch his. He took the oil pan off, put a bolt through with leather washers on both sides of the hole, and seal it up that way and keep going.
Those were the days.
Yeah. Well, it's really kind of fun. I complain about the road sometimes too, but the road was a lot different then than it is now. The closest thing we have to the original road, of course, the inside road is about the same as it ever was. But on the North Fork side, only from probably Holton's north to the border, it's pretty much on the same roadbed, same mud problems, same drainage problems, and it's very nearly like the road was then, except that over the years with power graders and stuff, they have widened it, so it's not a one-way road. It's basically a two-way road. But still, on the original track, and the road in many places is the lowest part of the terrain, so the water melts there. But see, people then laid in their groceries. Madge Cooper and Tyrion at the border would always have all of her groceries in by October 15th.
For the whole winter.
For the whole winter, because you didn't know. You know, any time after the 15th of October, it could snow and you'd be stuck. Mm-hmm. And the road, when it was snowed full, was not plowed all winter until late spring. Mm-hmm. And then, if there were logging jobs, the loggers would plow it. On occasion, the county would bring bulldozers and open the road. Trail Creek Road was the year that Tom Peterson died, whenever that was, 60s. Lloyd Saunderson brought his bulldozers up. Tom had spent the previous month at Colebridge, because he wanted to be on the North Fork, to die. And Lloyd Saunderson plowed Trail Creek Road to Tom's house so he could go home, and he died about a week later. Oh. In his own house, though,
yeah,
that he built. And then, of course, Marie lived for many years after that and wrote her book. And she was killed in a car accident just outside of Columbia Falls. But boy, yeah, the homesteaders were tough. And
so they really, they could be snowed in for the whole winter, basically.
Oh yeah, they expected to be snowed in for the whole winter. When I was in high school and college, we would come up the road as far as it was plowed, or whatever that might be. I can remember the year I was a freshman in college, it was plowed a Trail Creek Road for a logging job. The loggers kept it open. And then we snowshoed to the border to visit Madge and Ollie. Mm-hmm. Madge always had peanut butter, and Ollie loved peanut butter, but he didn't get to have any until some of us kids were there. Then she'd bring out the peanut butter. But we would hike to, just across Colts Creek and then cut across the hay meadow to the house. And when we got within sight of the house, we would shoot a hole in the chimney to let them know we were coming. And she'd have the peanut butter out and cocoa on by the time we got to the house.
So you didn't go to school up here, but there were some schools up here.
Not then.
The schools were over.
The schools closed during World War II. I think when you talk to Naomi, she can tell you. I think she was a first grader the last year there was a school up here. Her grandmother taught at the school. And so that would have been 43, 44, somewhere in that area. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was only grades 1 through 8 mm-hmm. when it was here. And it's interesting, the Land Use Planning Committee, input from the new landowners in the 80s, they didn't want to encourage a school up here because that would bring more people, which might cause the road to be paved, which might cause all kinds of disasters, I guess. Mm-hmm. But it gives people something to talk about.
So there were no schools up here after, except for
Jerry Wernick's boarding school.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And I'm not sure when he opened. It's been a while now. 80s maybe?
I think so. Yeah. So the social life up here, you said there were square dances once a month.
That was only in the summer.
And that was
In the summer they alternated between Kentler Ranch and Quarter Circle MC, but of course both of those operations closed in the winter, and somebody might stay at either place, but the roads weren't open, the roads weren't plowed. And so in the winter, the homestead families for years had gotten together for social events. Mm-hmm. Holcomb's was one of the most popular places because Lena had a piano. And so they just moved all the furniture, and danced, did square dances, whatever, in that small, if you go there, it's a pretty small living room by today's standards. But the thing I remember in the 50s were canasta parties. Everybody played canasta. And it's kind of a rummy game played with seven decks of cards. Oh. And it's a fairly lengthy game, and a lot of people can play, and if you need more people, you put double canasta decks together, and you could play as many as you wanted. And so there were card parties that went around from house to house. And then, as now, all the women were good cooks, I guess. Mm-hmm. There were a lot of dinner parties, but cards were a big thing. In the homestead days, they were heartier. We have our beach party now on New Year's Day, no matter
I've
what.
I've been there.
Yeah, we go down and have build a fire and have hot dogs and beans and spend 2 or 3 hours on the riverside. Well, in the homestead days, they would gather at the mouth of Trail Creek, usually in February, and they would camp there for a week, catching whitefish to can. They'd smoke them and can them, and the women would be doing that with, you know, they had tents set everywhere, and that's a 2 mile walk in there today, and it was then too. So,
everybody snowshoed in
and brought all their stuff and set up and had a big community camp.
It was probably cold.
Well, yeah, probably. You know, it's nasty here in the winter sometimes. But they didn't vary. It was a certain weekend in February was the height of the big fishing thing. But people didn't go to town. The only time, if people went to town, somebody was really sick or somebody died. Mid Connolly's grandfather died up here at his son's homestead, which is now owned by Hoyland's. And what was his name? Austin Weichert was the homesteader, and his father died. And various locals, including Charlie Wise, was there for the whole thing. They took a week to get his body to town in the winter.
A whole week.
They wrapped him up and broke trail for horses part of the way, pulled him on a sled out of there initially. And from Pole Bridge down, I know they used horses in a sled. I'm not sure where the horses actually started the pull, but they ended up, it took just nearly a week.
I wonder why they didn't just bury him up here.
Well, there was 4 feet of snow on the ground.
Oh, 4 feet of snow. Yeah, that would be a problem.
Yeah. And so, and he was froze stiff. They just left him on the sled at night, of course. So he didn't care. And they would go from one homestead to another. So no doubt some days they could have made it further, but they stopped at homesteads. Mm-hmm. And that's what people did then. Mm-hmm. You just stopped wherever you could for the night. Adair started his whole business by having an overnight place for people to stay. Mm-hmm. When Matt and Maida Brill got married, they came by horse and wagon up the inside road, stayed one night at Sullivan Meadows, one night somewhere just north of Pulbridge, Big Prairie probably, and were sure they could make it home to Kentler Ranch the third night, but the river was running high and they didn't make it in time, and it got dark, and it was raining hard. Mm. So they slept under the wagon the third night before getting home.
What time of year was that?
That was in June.
June?
Yeah, so the river was high and you don't just jump into it. But.
And people used to take horses and wagons across that river.
Yes, but June was not a good time. Mm-hmm. That's why they had the flying machines, the cable cars that people could ride across. And so you would arrange for people to pick you up from the other side. But, you know, in the homestead days, there were 14 homesteads in Big Prairie. Mm-hmm. And that was the initial settlement on the North Fork. But in 1910, that ended when it became Glacier Park, and the park didn't harass the homesteaders at first. It took them a couple of years to get going, and then they started pressing on the homesteaders and stopping them from hunting and trapping. And most of the homesteaders made their living by working for the park or the Forest Service in the summer and trapping and working on their homestead in the winter. Right. And the women were left home all summer many times. Mm-hmm. Maida Brill was a notable exception because she cooked at Lake McDonald Lodge and so did Matt, so they were gone together. But you hear the stories of the big fires in the late 20s, Holcombs buried a lot of their possessions, you know, when they abandoned the place because they were afraid it would burn. It didn't. But they didn't find all their stuff afterwards either. So they couldn't remember where everything was. So I don't know what they were missing. The only treasure I know about on the North Fork was the winter of 1946-47, Kentla Ranch Lodge burned to the ground. And the guy who had been managing it that year disappeared about 3 days later, and all of the income from the hunting season disappeared with it.
Oh.
So he always maintained it was in the lodge when it burnt. But I don't think so. Because the story was that there were 200 silver dollars included in those checks of money. And I've been over that site with a metal detector and never found any silver dollars. But we did find the silver, Matt Brill's, or Maida Brill's silk, good silver in a metal box under the ashes. Well, since I've been here, there have been 3 major floods. Well, relatively speaking, we thought the 48 flood was a big flood. It flooded about waist deep in all of the river cabins at Kintler Ranch. It took a lot of cleanup. But the big flood, of course, was 64, where parts of the main road were gone, the valley was really flooded, and houses were damaged up here, but not washed away, even in 64. The road was washed away in some places, and John Frederick's hostel was wet, and there were other places that got wet. But the most devastating flood up here probably was 95 or 96, and it was not really a flood anywhere but here, and it was mostly caused by a big log jam below Pole Bridge that backed the water up.
Oh.
And so it was backed up at Kentler Ranch, where it did not flood in 64. Cabins flooded again. But they didn't flood for very long. 3 or 4 hours and the dam broke and the water receded. But it was a lot of cleanup. I don't think the hostel was ever really clean till Oliver moved in.
Mm-hmm.
He gets in every crack and cranny. So there haven't been, flooding is not a big thing, although this last spring, a lot of people worried and bought flood insurance, but I wasn't one of them because I'm a mile from the river.
Right.
And up 2 benches. And so it's neat to live on the river, but you have to understand the risks if you do that.
Right.
Fires, well, north of Trail Creek, 1910 fire, 1910 fires burnt a lot of the North Fork. And then there were no fires till the 20s. And then there were no big fires again. The years I worked with the forest, there was from 55 to 60, We were praying for a fire to get the overtime. And we had a couple little fires and not much overtime, but not many fires up here. I think the spruce beetle epidemic, removed so much of the spruce that eliminated major fires for a long time. And then in 1988, we had the Red Bench Fire, which was, gosh, beyond anybody's belief. And it was nearly 50,000 acres. And then the Moose Fire came in 2001, and Robert and Wedge came in 2003. And so now about 70% of the North Fork's been burned over again. So it'll take 20 or 30 years. And I don't know. People say, well, if you fight fires, you just postpone big fires. And my feeling is if you manage the forest, you don't ever have big fires, because if you properly manage, you would have mixed age trees in every drainage. And we saw those big fires. People are all against the big clear cuts. But when you drive out of here and get out on the bluff there where you can see all the open mountains and stuff and look kind of southwest, you'll see a big green patch, 100 acres or more. And that big green patch was right in the middle of the Wedge Fire. But it had been clear cut 25 years before, and the trees were just second growth trees, and they were 15, 20 feet high. And that big fire, when it came into it, burnt hot on the edge and then just slowly went to the ground as it went in and didn't penetrate over about 100 yards. Same thing is true of fire breaks that were built behind Ford Ranger Station. And if you do that so that you never have too much old timber and not too much young timber, decide what I don't have any answers to that. What is the right mix? I don't know. 10% old growth, that's, I think, a rule today, or 6% old growth forest. Mm-hmm. Well, it seems to me if you set it up like a bell curve, okay, 6%, those are the A's, and you had 6% that are bare ground just being ready for replanting, and then you set percentages of forest in each drainage. Now, it can't be forest-wide. It's got to be just in each drainage. So that you've got old growth, you've got mature timber, you've got stuff that's ready for commercial thinning, stuff that's ready for pre-commercial thinning, and newly planted. And all those stages of forest laid out properly will prevent a fire that starts on a Whitefish Divide going to the Continental Divide, because that's what they do here. They blow from west to east. Mm-hmm. But I haven't been hired to be dictator yet, so might not happen. Actually, that's not an original idea with me. The first person where I heard it was the forest supervisor at Flathead National Forest named Ed Brannan. Mm-hmm. And that's what he wanted to set up in the forest plan. And I don't know if they ever got a forest plan done. Mm-hmm. They're still fighting about it, I think.
So when you bought this property, then what happened here with your, did you build this cabin yourself?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
The cabinet's my photo studio. It was 12 by 15 inside. Mm-hmm. That was a homestead cabin. And that was the only building here.
Was it already here?
It was still here.
And it was an original homestead cabin? And whose was that?
It was a fellow by the name of Rue. I never met him. Mm-hmm. They were long gone. Mm-hmm. And during the Depression, they left. And the land went back to the county for taxes, and Tom Reynolds bought it. And he used that little cabin when he was here cutting wood. But it had a sod roof. And he had tacked cardboard, and I don't know what all in the to absorb. Mm-hmm. He opened the door, and it just stunk horribly because it was moldy, and it didn't have a stove. We took the roof off and put a 2x4 solid roof on it, and used it for several years till I could afford to build this place. And when I built this cabin, let's see, it was about early 1960s. I think Lynn Ogle's parents put the foundation blocks in for this cabin. Early 60s. And then I was teaching school in Columbia Falls, and I hired Ollie Terrian to be the builder. Mm-hmm. I had an old John Deere tractor, and all the logs here were standing dead lodgepole that came not just from this property, but from all my neighbors. Everybody said, any standing dead, take it, you can have them. And so we drug the logs into the tractor and put up a gin pole and built this cabin. And when we got, things like putting on the roof, my students from town came up, and I didn't have to work at all. I just set up a kitchen outside, and because every boy I ever had in the eighth grade, I would bring them up in groups of five, and we would stay in that little 12 by 15 cabin, and that's why I needed a bigger cabin. And the kids that I'd had previous years, the football team, when we put the roof on it, all the lumber went on this roof in one day. About 3 hours, actually, because I had the whole football team was here, and I'd had them all in school, and so they came up. They won a football game on Friday night, first time they won a football game in quite a while, and they came up here, and I cooked, and they put the roof on.
And there were so many great time.
Oh, there were so many kids here that they stood on the scaffolding. We built the scaffolding the weekend before, and so guys on the roof could just stand there on the scaffolding. And kids from below would hand up the lumber. It was 1 by 12 boards. And they just stood in one place and nailed down their little section of the board, and another board was coming up, and they just kept going, and it just was all on. No time.
That's great. So when did you finish? What year did you finish your cabin? Of course, cabins are never finished, but you know.
No, I'm not sure. Mid-60s, probably, mm-hmm. early 60s, about 63, 64, somewhere in there it was finished. Mm-hmm. Not as it is today. The shell, what you see here that's log, was done then. Mm-hmm. And then we had a boys camp here for several years, another school teacher in Columbia Falls and I. And over time, when I stopped teaching and started logging, we would do most of our work up here. And one time I had a crew of 25. Mm-hmm. And so we built a kitchen on it. Mm-hmm. And needed a shower. So we built the shower on, and then didn't even think about a toilet. Didn't think about it, you know. We'd used the outhouse for so many years that nobody, you just didn't think about it. But I was up here one winter shortly after that alone and got sick with the flu. Mm-hmm. And I'll tell you, going from bed to outhouse, or from bed to boots, to warm coat to outhouse, and then back,
when
boots off
sick.
And into bed.
Yeah.
Boy, that was a real trial. And so the next year I put another addition on the back of the kitchen, and we have a septic system and toilet now, in addition to the shower. The shower was an unheard of, you know, really neat
uptown
modernization. Yeah. Before that, the crew would go, well, when we were working here, we would eat breakfast at 5:30 in the morning. The guys would be on the job by 6, and then they'd be done by 2. That's when they'd quit normally. At the latest, sometimes if things went well, you know, they got their job done earlier. So then they would fish, swim. So baths were in the river or trail creek. We used to lay in the water under the Trail Creek Bridge. And it was kind of dangerous if you were really tired, because getting up, you know, I was getting up at 4:30 then. And by mid-afternoon, I was really dragging sometimes, and I fell asleep a couple times down there laying in the water and woke up really cold.
Yeah.
Because that water is cold. It felt good on 90-degree days. But.
So in the days when you were logging, did you stay up here year-round, or?
Different years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, some years we did. The year we logged foremans, we were here all winter. Mostly what I tried to do was get jobs in the valley for the winter, come here in the spring and stay till. We always stayed here till Thanksgiving, logging. Mm-hmm. And it depended. You'd get an open winter and we could stay longer. We'd stay on the job until we had to move to town. But, you know, we cut posts and logged over most of the North Fork.
Mm-hmm.
We did all of the property that's now Morris's, several of the neighbors there, Fischel's, Ladenburg's. Mm-hmm. We worked on Ladenburg's right up to the day he sold it to the government. And I think we worked on Fischel's for 5 years, Ladenburg's for 5 or 6.
Mm-hmm.
We were logging on Fischel's in 88 when the Red Bench fire came through. But yeah, we didn't stay all winter usually. It's a long winter.
Mm-hmm. It is a long winter.
Because if you log properly, you don't want to leave high stumps. So we always promised landowners we would cut stumps lower than 8 inches.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if there's 4 feet of snow on the ground, that means a lot of digging before you even saw the tree down. And then it's dangerous too, because you've got that well, the hole that it's in,
yeah.
The lip of it can cause the tree to change how it falls. So,
mm-hmm.
Exciting times. Though.
Yeah. Well, tell me about the North Fork Improvement Association. When did it start? And
North Fork Improvement Association started in 1947. And it was started to improve the road, bring telephones and electricity to the North Fork, and to give the landowners a voice in fish and game regulations. And I hate the changed name. I almost never joined again after they changed the name to Landowners Association. People in California have Landowners Associations, you know. And if people aren't smart enough to know that the Improvement Association was a landowners organization, which was one of the arguments for changing it, they're not very bright and they shouldn't be here anyway. But every year, I think I'm going to put in a proposed amendment to change it back, and keep doing it every year till they change it, which is basically what the people did that got it changed to Landowner Association. They tried it once and it failed badly, and the second time I thought, oh, this is dumb, and I didn't argue about it, and it passed. And I thought, but I think you'll find, as you talk to longtime landowners, that there's a lot of resentment about that name change. Still to this day. even though it's not your fault. Mm-hmm. But, or any of the officers today's fault. It happened by a vote of the membership. Mm-hmm. But the old timers don't like it. And the idea was to, like I say, improve the road, bring electricity and phones, and have a say in fish and wildlife things, matters. Well, we do that still. And we've gone through a lot of changes from bitter battling. For a period of time, the local people didn't join the Improvement Association. And it became mostly a social thing up here. And that wasn't because the social thing was organized and carried out mostly by summer people, and the locals weren't here for that. Mm-hmm. You know, their social lives were different, they were working, mm-hmm. didn't have the time that the summer residents had, or whatever the reasons, it wasn't that anybody was fighting with anybody initially. But over time, then the summer residents were concerned about more and more subdivision, and so they started a drive to zone the North Fork. Mm-hmm. Well, that got the locals interested. And so then we had several years where the two groups showed up and we'd have 150 people at election night. People who had never been to a meeting for years joined and came to vote. And it was the locals versus the summer residents. And the locals won. I don't know if that would happen today, if they could win today, but the locals won. My dad was a big ringleader in that whole process, and Gus Sonnenberg, because they were against zoning. Because most of the locals, there was still a large number of the locals whose major assets were their land. Mm-hmm. And they didn't think that it was quite right that the summer residents had come in and bought these subdivisions up, and now they wouldn't have a chance to do the same thing when they wanted to. And there was some reason on their side, and there's also some reason on the other side that, okay, when is the area just changed so much that you can't stand it anymore, it's not the same. Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know where that is. It's changed now, so it's not like it was from the homestead days. But in many ways, we have many similarities today. Mm-hmm. You know, people, by and large, even people who disagree, get along. Mm-hmm. People who dislike other neighbors will still stop and help them if they're stuck on the road. Mm-hmm. And part of it's because we rely on each other, as well as, you know, if you don't have to talk to somebody or see them, it's easy for you to decide they're no good. Mm-hmm. And we have some of that here, but the homesteaders had some of that too. They had people that fought. You know, Billy Cruz was considered a jerk by everybody up here, except Tom Reynolds, who thought he was a great guy. And Tom Reynolds outlasted almost everybody else, so Billy Cruz became a better guy. But now, we've got a pretty good balance. And then, over time, we made peace. But mid-80s, Len Ogle and I became heavily involved in the association. We were back-to-back presidents, and our big goal was to unite the community. And we did that with the help of John Frederick and Mike Connors, who worked for the Forest Service, and we set up the interlocal agreement. Mm-hmm. Okay, we're unhappy with the government. And those first meetings were quite contentious because North Fork residents were mad at the agencies. Mm-hmm. Didn't like the Wild Scenic River thing. Didn't like everything. Hardly anything we liked. They weren't fixing the road right. They weren't grading it often enough. They weren't, you know. And we had, I think, two meetings, and then the agency said, oh, wait a minute, you know, we listened to all your gripes, now you need to listen to some of ours, too, so we'll set up a second meeting. So we turned it from a once-a-year meeting on the North Fork to a twice-a-year meeting. So the one on the North Fork is hosted by the private groups, the one in the town in the winter is hosted by the agencies, and the idea originally was that then the agencies could shoot back, you know, and talk about their concerns with what landowners are doing wrong. Mm-hmm. And it has kind of evolved from that to, for a while I wasn't sure we should continue it even. It became such a good old boy thing, everybody slapping each other on the back and talking about how great things are. and not addressing the issues. And a meeting, if you address the issues, a meeting can be quite long. You know, you get, mm-hmm. especially if it's an argumentative type thing. But I think the current trend is that if the landowners will in advance decide what's bothering them, even if it's just one landowner, and that word gets to the agency that's involved, so that the agency knows the questions before they come to the meeting and they come to the meeting to answer those issues, that we have a chance. Otherwise, we get people who want to interpret the Constitution of the United States and, you know, whatever. And it doesn't, don't sit, tell Duke I said that. Because he feels so strongly about it, and it just isn't a place, that's all. Jimmy D. Herrera does not decide what the Forest Service is going to do, he just carries out what he's told. And but if we have an argument with the Forest Service, Jimmy is still the one to tell it to, because he can pass it on. And if it continues to be a problem, then we have the option of going above him and above them and above them until we get to the people that do it. But there's no sense badgering a patrolman in the Border Patrol about the Homeland Security's wasted money. He doesn't know. He's just hired and does what he's told. So to me, they are just like anybody else who wears a uniform. You know, we should support them. Maybe we don't support the people who set the policies, but them we certainly support. But we have a bigger government presence, but in many ways, but the Forest Service was the big neighbor up here, you know, during logging times. And when they were logging, then money went to the schools, money was also spent on opening trails, and that money has slowly disappeared with the logging money. And I'm a big believer in sustained yield basis, operate, you know, where you can cut the same amount every year, create mixed age forests like I was telling you about, and there's always a constant supply of money, and it's better for the wildlife, because the wildlife still has the same amount of space. When we get to the point where we're just involved emotionally, you know, God love the grizzly bear. Well, some grizzly bears are good, they're like people. Some of them are pretty good, some of them are really good, some of them are lousy neighbors. And, you know, I'm against grizzly bears in the house, except like this one.
That's a beautiful bear right there. Where, is there a story behind this?
Not really. My dad shot him when they were legal to shoot down at Kendall Ranch, right by the barn.
Do you have any good animal stories? Like animal encounters or?
The best. Well, I told you the one about Ralph there jumping over a log and landing in a grizzly bear.
Tell me that again.
Well, he was running out of the woods. It's on the tape, so you got it already.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, that one. Yeah.
One of the best stories is Bonnie Ogle's mountain lion story. Before they had their cabin built, they used to stay here a lot, and we were here in the winter. I'm not sure what time, Thanksgiving time, I think. And that was before we had the indoor toilets, and Bonnie, with her flannel nightgown and her winter coat and her winter boots, went to the outhouse. And she was gone a long time, to the point where we were thinking about yelling out there, did you fall in or something? And she came back in the kitchen door and said, oh, beautiful. I said, beautiful what? Cat. Mountain. And she said, mountain lion. And we ran out, and the mountain lion was just walking off through the trees. Well, she was in the outhouse, sitting on the seat, and the mountain lion stuck his head in the door. And the door was wide, you know, she had the door wide open. You can see the door is protected from the house by branches from the spruce tree. Just stuck his head right in and looked at her. And she will tell you, she knew she couldn't get down the hole. There was no place to run. She just sat there. And finally, who knows, it probably seemed longer to her than it really was, but finally, she said, it backed up and walked out of sight. So she got up, ready to run for the house, and when she got to the door of the outhouse, he had turned around, his head was peering around the corner at her again. So she froze again, and then ran for the house when the cat turned. And I took my rifle, I was going to shoot the damn cat. No, he's a beautiful cat. She wouldn't let me shoot at him. So he safely got away.
Yeah.
But probably the scariest stories in the North Fork, you know, don't involve grizzly bears or wolves, but things like, well, Mark Heathy can tell you. He's had this experience this hunting season. Nothing like coming around a corner and being face to face with a skunk.
Oh.
That's scarier than anything. You know, open this door to go outside the night to go to the bathroom, see a skunk right outside the door. You'd be surprised how you can control your bladder after that. But there have not been a lot of grizzly bear attacks up here.
Mm-hmm. There haven't. Yeah.
You know, Jerry DeSanto was mauled by a bear at Kintla Lake. Mm-hmm. Ralph Thayer in the, God, when was that? Who knows? I don't know, 20s maybe. I've got it in the Forest Service records, but Robbie Barnaby got mauled about 5 years ago down by Moran. Mm-hmm. But bears don't bother you. Really, I've come to be a believer in bear spray for defending yourself from mm-hmm. bears. It's just a matter of aim, you know. A rifle bullet's a half inch across. A bear spray is 5 feet across immediately. Well, your chances of hitting him in the face are a lot better with a bear spray. Mm-hmm. And it's very effective.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm glad other people had to test it, not me. But I have never had an encounter with a grizzly bear. And I walk quietly through the woods.
Mm.
I don't yell or ring bells or anything. You know, when I go for a walk in the woods, I go because I want to see things. And so, and my dad was a big believer when you hunt, that if you could hear yourself, a deer could hear you for half a mile.
Mm-hmm.
So you better go really slow. It would take my dad 15 minutes to get out of sight from the front door of the cabin here when he was going hunting. So, you know, I go really slow, and the older I get, the slower I go. And now I'll go out away from the house with the ATV, carry my folding chair, and then I'll just sit. But you'd be surprised. If you sit for 15 minutes, you'll see something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it might just be a bird or a chipmunk or a fast-moving caterpillar, but that's also how you see bears and deer and moose, and mm-hmm. and they won't bother you. They're not bears don't hunt people. People hunt bears, and other animals, too.
Mm-hmm.
So mm-hmm. I don't know of many scary stories up here, really.
So, how about, what do you think about, how has it changed? How has the North Fork changed? You've touched on it a little bit during this interview.
Well, we've become more modernized. We have mm-hmm. cars that have air conditioning, ride better, and are better road. The road is much better.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, and well, no one would argue that the last 2 or 3 years has become much, much better mm-hmm. than it was. We have better communication. You know, in the homestead days, the only communication they had was there were two phone lines. One that came up the inside road, that was park line, and the Forest Service line. And those were number 9 wire, you know, like 2 tin cans on a wire is what they really were. And you could talk on them. But if the lines were all open, Ford Ranger Station was a switching station, kind of. So when I worked there, big part of the day was how you set up communication with the lookouts.
Mm-hmm.
Thoma lookout, cyclone lookout, you know, all the ones down the line. Because if you left those lines open, then the ringing circuit wouldn't ring.
Mm-hmm.
And you couldn't hear each other, it became too faint. So you'd shut off the line to Thoma, or the line to the border for a while, so you could talk to somebody at Pole Bridge. And then Pole Bridge would call you and you'd ring the border and hook them together and turn everybody else off. But not everybody, because everybody was on one line. So, Kentler Ranch, our phone rang was 2 longs and 2 shorts. But whenever the phone rang, everybody ran to the phone, and you listened in. And of course, the more people that listened, the weaker the signal got. Uh-huh. So, when my mother was calling Belton to put in the grocery order to have it ready for when she went to get groceries, very often she'd have to say, "Will some of you hang up so I can get this through to Belton?" And they would. But otherwise, people just listen. That was part of the social life, I guess, and listening in to other people's phone conversations.
Like your radio line. Thing now, where everybody...
Well, yeah, see, and that's a big change. We now have, I think there's probably at least two networks of radios up here, St. Ange, and those people use, I don't know, it's a marine band or something, but, you know, there's a group of them that talk to each other. On the north end here, almost all of us are search and rescue members, mm-hmm. and so we operate on search and rescue frequencies and respond to rescues, and it gives us a network. Mm-hmm. We give a portable to Nancy Hubble. She's 80 some years old. She's here all alone, so we give her radio. Now, she doesn't call us every morning. And we have check-in at 8 in the morning. Mm-hmm. And so let's see, the Trail Creek group checks in. Mark and Margaret are in the, kind of in the middle. John Frederick and Oliver are on the network, but they don't often report in. But they are a link that we can call to get on a landline, a regular phone line. Mm-hmm. And of course, Lee Downs now is just gone, but mm-hmm. he was our south end. So we had communication on the whole North Fork. When it was mm-hmm. extreme fire season, we would check in twice a day. And we had different places that different members went to watch for smokes and lightning strikes and whatever. So it, that okay. really works. And I, how many are on the one that St. Ange's and those other people are on, I don't know, but they do pretty much the same thing. Although it was funny when Ed St. Ange, who doesn't belong to the North Fork Patrol or to the Trail Creek Irregulars, reported it interlocally. He was really upset because Lynn and I didn't tell him about what was going on with the Ninko fire 2 years ago. Hmm. Well, we were the ones that, after 10 o'clock at night, got in our car, drove down, talked to the Forest Service people, looked at the fire, mm-hmm. and listened to their plans, and then notified all of our people. You know, if he wants us, we don't owe that to everybody. Yeah. We're glad to share it, but if you want to know what we know about fires, you call us, and we'll tell you everything we know about fires. Uh-huh. But if you think we're going to go house to house,
yeah,
it right. just gets beyond what you can do.
Yeah.
You know, and we were... I don't know, it was 2 o'clock in the morning time we got done with the people we knew that were on the radio and get down there and talk to those people and come back. And so I was a little, you know, surprised that he would attack us in a public meeting because he'd never said a word to any of us before that. And the best way to communicate is to talk to your neighbors.
That's right.
You know, it's not to just be mad because they didn't talk to you. But we have that communication. People have satellite phones now. You know, whoever would have dreamt we'd have television? I've got 250 channels of television, and I can watch the news and everything. When we first moved here, it was very difficult to have any radio in the daytime. At night, radio reception got better. And the thing my dad hated to miss was a Joe Louis fight. Mm. And the best radio we had was a car radio, and he would run a wire from car radio antenna to the barbed wire fence and get it all set up so we could listen to most of the fight because it would get strong and then get weak and you know, hope there wasn't a knockout before it came back and then it'd come back. Most homesteaders up here had dry cell battery radios. The dry cell was about this long and it's wide, about a foot and a half long by a foot wide and 4 or 5 inches deep. And they lasted quite a long time. They were a dry battery, but you had to be very careful. So most people up here would listen like 5 o'clock news or mm-hmm. whatever. If they had one program they liked to listen to, they'd do that. As the winter wore on and the battery got weaker, then they would warm the battery by putting it in the cook stove oven to warm it, and that'd make it better for a while. But you had to be real careful about those things because you couldn't. Yeah. They'd go dead just sitting in the house even. So now we can communicate. Law enforcement has good radios. We have alert landing sites mm-hmm. up here. The helicopter can be here in 30 minutes, mm-hmm. weather permitting. The Border Patrol, bless their hearts, are up and down the road every day. Mm-hmm. And they're also paying, what is it, Operation Stone Garden? The sheriff's office, there was a sheriff's officer stopped by here yesterday. Mm-hmm. You lay down. That's the dog I'm talking to, not Devil. So our communication is much better. Our living facilities are much easier.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we still have to have some backup things. Like I have electricity for the generator, but if the generator fails, that doesn't mean I don't have heat or anything else. I still got propane backup, lights, refrigerator, cook stove, Coleman lanterns. I guess if push came to shove, where most homesteaders had kerosene lamps, and maybe they had an Aladdin lamp that was really bright,
mm-hmm.
but you have to sit right beside those to run them,
because
they get hotter and hotter, and then they blow the mantle. We have, think about what the homesteaders would think if they saw Mike Eddy coming with his snowblower. 8 feet wide, blowing snow 20 feet into the air. You know, they were just, when the snow came, they just sat still.
Mm-hmm.
You got your wood in, you got your groceries in, you had a full root cellar. You could survive the winter. And the only people you saw really were the people within walking distance.
Mm-hmm.
And their walking distance was more like Mark and Margaret's than it is mine. Mark and Margaret come on foot, you know, to the beach party. And I don't know what it is, 9 miles one way or so.
At least.
Yeah, and the rest of us go by snowmobile from my house or something. But those people got around by walking.
Mm-hmm.
Their stories, I've got some printed material written by one of the old school teachers at Ford Ranger Station, you know, where she came to a party by foot to Kentler Ranch in the winter. And I don't know if it was a dinner party, card party, what, but she was walking home and the wolves were howling. And she was not too sure about that, whether she was going to make it back home or not. Actually, the wolves never attacked her, but it made a good story. But you think she came, whether it was for dinner or cards or what it was, just a social evening,
mm-hmm.
she came 5.5 miles on foot, on snowshoes, to Matt Brill's, spent whatever time of the evening, walked back in the dark to Ford Ranger Station, and had school the next day.
They were tough, weren't they?
Yeah, where she was responsible for getting in the wood and packing the water and all of those things.
Yeah. Pretty amazing.
And I don't know what they were paid then. In 1960, my first salary in Columbia Falls was $42.25. So, but of course, at that time, I thought if I could just make $5,000 a year, I'd have more money than I could spend.
Times change.
And times change. And now, starting teacher's salary in Columbia Falls is $30,000 a year.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they live much better than we did on $42.25. It's just an economy of growth.
That's good. Okay, Larry, well, is there anything you think I've forgotten to ask you?
I can't imagine. I've talked for how long? For hours now, it seems like.
Well, thank you so much. This was great.
Oh, I enjoy it. And we'll think of things that I missed or something. But
mm-hmm. We will. We'll have a follow-up, probably.